It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up later on the show, we'll discuss the discovery of asbestos fibers at the proposed iron mining site in northern Wisconsin, and what it means for the current debate.
But first, the world's population is expected to hit 9 billion by the year 2050, and many people are left wondering how we're going to feed all of them. But according to our next guest, instead of worrying about producing more food, maybe we should take a closer look at how we use the food that we've got now.
What we're already doing is wasting food. 40% of the food grown in the U.S. ends up in the trash one way or another. Our next guest says dealing with this waste is going to be the next revolution in food.
Joining us now is Rehan Hermansi, deputy editor at Modern Farmer, and her piece, Food Waste, the Next Food Revolution, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Rehan, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be here.
Well, your article points to a lot of ways different people are trying to reduce food waste, but it sort of begs the question, how did this get to be such a huge problem? We're talking about 40, close to 50% of food waste per year.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that in the U.S. and a lot of Western nations, we got here thanks to consumer waste, and a big part of that is the way the cost of food has changed over time. Food is cheaper these days than it ever has been. And I think that a lot of people point that to that as a big factor in consumer waste.
There's a statistic, I think, that I've heard that the food thrown away in developed nations equals the entire food produced in 1 year of a growing season in sub-Saharan Africa. It kind of blows the mind.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the numbers we looked at were really just at such a huge scale, you know, and especially when you put that in, as you said before, the context of a growing population on the planet and how are we feeding them, it does seem that if we could get a hold of food waste in its variety of forms, then that would really, it would go part of the way to solving that problem.
Give us a sense of where most of the world's food waste is coming from. Who's doing it?
Well, so when we started looking around, we realized pretty quickly that research shows that the model for food waste in developing nations and Western nations is almost a complete inverse, where in a lot of developing nations, most of the food waste happens going from farm to market, you know, kind of a lot of technological challenges with refrigeration, you know, sort of efficient systems, et cetera, waste food. But on the Western side, it's coming from consumers. And the U.S. is one of the biggest leaders in terms of just amount of food waste. But then per capita, there's a lot of countries that also can be kind of pretty bad offenders, like the U.K., for instance.
Now, is it individual people mostly that we're talking about, stuff that goes bad in our refrigerators and we just chuck it out, or are we looking at sort of large-scale food waste?
Well, it kind of has to be, you sort of have to look at it all. A big part of it in countries like the U.S. and the U.K. and Europe in developed nations is consumers just throwing stuff away from our refrigerators, or restaurants throwing stuff away, or kind of like, call it post-consumer waste, what we throw away from our fridges. But then there's a lot of other different kinds of waste. For instance, supermarkets these days are very sensitive to the idea that they think consumers don't want to see damaged produce, which means that a lot of times food gets thrown away, like, you know, bananas that are bruised that are perfectly edible but may not be the best looking.
Is part of it, too, that we're conditioned to want to buy these giant economy-sized packages of things now, too, and maybe we just can't eat the giant family size?
Yeah. One study the University of Arizona did showed that 14% of the waste they saw from Americans was unopened containers, which is, you know, maybe one of the, I mean, that's sort of like the worst end when you're kind of throwing away packaged goods. But, you know, there's a lot of room and ways to improve, too. There's a lot of new companies out there that are trying to get a better hold of the data. It turns out that we don't really know that much these days about where we're wasting. Because the price of food is so low, a lot of people and businesses kind of, you know, are like, well, it's easier just to throw that out and to try to figure out the labor costs of, like, you know, counting, you know, just where we're actually throwing away these goods.
So it's one thing to say that we're throwing away a lot of food. Everyone, I assume, feels that or hears that and feels kind of guilty, probably as they should. But then on the other hand, you know, what do we do to convince people that we should care and that it actually has maybe an economic impact on, you know, the price of food and on our own budgets?
Well, you know, we looked at the UK as a place where a lot of there are a lot of really great public programs, private-public partnerships designed to raise awareness around food waste that seem to be working. These efforts, led by this group called RAP, you know, brought grocery stores in the mix and created these, you know, these sort of forward-looking kind of cool events. We talked to some people who suggested that, you know, watching out for food waste was, you know, I think dumpster diving has a certain pejorative in the U.S., but they were looking at it slightly differently, and it became sort of respectable to care about food waste.
And how do people respond when they become aware? What should they be doing, ideally, if the message is hitting home?
Well, I think that you can look inside your own fridge and your own kitchen in terms of, you know, what, you know, when you're throwing stuff out, why are you throwing it out? We included a list of tips in the story. So I think when you're shopping, think about, like, are you buying what you need? Or are you just kind of, like, grabbing the biggest thing? I think, you know, food banks do a lot of great work. And then if you have extra food you're not eating, you should sort of be in touch with them. There's a lot of apps you can use these days to help you kind of meal plan. And then, you know, go to a restaurant, take a doggy bag, you know. And then I think on the sort of larger scale, I think that grocery stores, food retailers, and even farms should take a harder look at a lot of the food that's being rejected for aesthetic reasons. And I think that in an even bigger kind of holistic way, and something Modern Farmer is very interested in, is kind of thinking about, like, maybe, you know, shop at farmers markets, kind of get closer to the source of your food, grow your own food. Like, it's a lot harder to kind of waste if you don't understand what is going into the work of growing food, which is, I think, some people have been theorizing that's why we waste more now. We just are a little bit more removed from it than we used to be.
It seems like in the environmental movement right now, there's a lot of emphasis on personal responsibility, you know, taking the bus or biking instead of hopping in your car. But what is being done to sort of change the culture of waste at a bigger level, maybe at a legislative level, maybe, you know, at a cross-country effort for grocery store chains, for instance?
Well, I think that the first step when we talked to a lot of people seemed to be research. Like, before we really could figure out solutions, obviously we need to understand the problems better. And last year, the NRDC put out a really good report on food waste that I think awakened a lot of people and different political stakeholders in terms of, you know, that's where we got numbers like 43 billion pounds of food in the U.S. was thrown away just on the retail level. So data is, I think, one of the biggest pieces. And then, you know, public policy campaigns, raising awareness, that's a big piece for the consumers. And then I think also giving grocery stores and other food retailers tools to better sort of save their food or funnel it into food banks or other programs that don't put these things in the landfills. And then also I think there's a technology component where there are certain municipalities and even private companies looking at these, they're called anaerobic digesters. And basically that's trying to get food out of our landfills, which is another kind of related problem to food waste. So these digesters are taking, like, basically a material of compost and turning it into energy. A lot of activists don't feel like we should be focusing on that because that doesn't actually stop the flow of waste. We kind of create another sort of thing to fill when you're looking at creating energy from this, but it definitely helps the environmental impact of food waste.
Well, right now we're talking with Rehan Harmansi about food waste in the United States, and we want to hear from you. Is this something that's on your radar? Do you feel guilty when you throw out stuff from your fridge? And what sort of things are you throwing away? What about those expiration dates? Are you kind of religiously observant about throwing stuff out when it's past it? And should we be? Another question we'll get to. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
We're picking up our conversation about food waste in the United States and around the world, and we want to hear from you. Have you taken steps to reduce the amount of stuff and food that you throw away? Why do you think we are so prone to chuck out good food? Is it just because it's past the expiration date? And where do you see people wasting a lot of food? Is it at a farm, at a grocery store? Maybe you're the chief culprit. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And Rehan, I want to talk about the expiration dates because, you know, just from a personal perspective, I used to think that you do not mess with the expiration dates. It's even a day before I would chuck it out, until my husband told me that they were more like gentle suggestions. How do you see expiration dates?
Well, I went through a similar education process around expiration dates. Now I see them as basically useless for consumers. Harvard University and NRDC came out with a report this fall about expiration dates that had a bunch of interesting facts. And one of them that there's no federal rules around expiration dates, so states make different rules. And then in addition to that, individual stores start chains label things differently. So you go into a store in Massachusetts and see, you know, a bunch of sell-by, best-by stickers on it. There's a bunch of laws around expiration in Massachusetts. Next door in New York State, there's actually no laws about expiration dates. So the stickers you see there are voluntary, and it can mean a bunch of different things.
So who's responsible for the drive in expiration dates? Why are they there at all if they don't help the consumer?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different verbiage in these expiration dates that mean different things. Apparently in the 70s, there was a moment when Congress almost made a national law around them, but then failed to do so. So, like, for instance, sell-by dates usually are just for employees who are, you know, sort of putting the stuff out so you can look at. They don't have any kind of information that indicates, like, food safety. And then best by dates a lot of times are the same sort of thing. They're really kind of designed to inform employees about how to stock things.
Well, let's go to our calls right now. And we've got Steve in Winona, Minnesota. Hey, Steve.
Hi.
What do you think?
Oh, well, I worked at a grocery store chain, Raley's, out in Reno, Nevada in 2005. And the amount of waste, you know, from their in-house bakery and deli and meat department, I mean, they had to throw away on a daily basis, you know, all this food and such under the locked, you know, dumpster and stuff. Nobody could, you know, come on the outside and get it or anything. And it's all a liability issue, you know, as far as, you know, well, we can't give it away. It's, you know, you're talking about outdated or something. Well, I don't think anybody's ever got sick from a stale donut or something, but they still had to throw it away. And they told us that, you know, the grocery stores only work off like a half a cent or a penny, you know, profit, but they, $45 million a year, and I'm not sure how many stores Raley's had, but that's how much they said they throw away every year.
All right. Well, thanks for that perspective, Steve. You know, he's talking about grocery store waste and mentioned the locked dumpsters. So I guess that prevents dumpster diving. Would it be helpful if big stores just left their dumpsters accessible to people?
Well, I think Steve raised a really good point, which is that, I mean, there's a difference between prepared food rules around donation and then canned goods. You can't really give prepared food, even donuts or, you know, other things that don't really usually carry a lot of safety problems. you can't donate those to food shelters, which is why restaurants waste so much, because they you know, there's liability issues there. So the U.S. actually does have some good laws around donation that shield food banks and other places from being sued, but they also have other rules that make it harder to donate food. So I think that I think there might be still might need to be some work done in this arena.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Steve, for your call. And let's go next to Jill in Oconomowoc. Hi, Jill.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you think about food waste? Yes, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Well, I was calling in. I never do this, but because this is something that I've been kind of passionate about in the last couple of years, I work in an elementary school,
mm-hmm.
and I see so much waste of the food that these children are having at their lunches. And part of the problem, it's so multitude. It's partly the parents, I think, and partly the food service, and partly the children, of course. But it's, I don't know, I see so much going to the garbage, and I try my best, individual by individual student, to, you know, make a difference, just by talking to them about making choices of something that they might like or not like, you know, asking their mm-hmm. parents to make them a half of a sandwich instead of a whole sandwich, asking the food service if they could cut the fruit, an apple or an orange, instead of giving it to them whole. I'm not sure how a first grade or kindergartner or even second, third, or fourth can cut, you know, deal with a whole orange when they have another, you know, their sandwich to eat.
In a short lunch hour, right. Well, thank you, Jill,
yes.
for that thought. So what about schools as places where food gets wasted?
Yeah, I mean, I think that institutions like hospitals and schools are definitely a place where a lot of food gets wasted. I talked to an organization called Lean Path that works with universities and schools and other kind of non-grocery store and non-restaurant dining places to reduce food waste. And a lot of it comes down to collecting data, educating workers. Until Lean Path goes into places, a lot of times people just don't know what they're wasting. So I think, you know, if you can kind of get more structure around recording what you're wasting and what you're not, people can make better choices.
Okay, well, thank you for the call, Jill. And on to Mike and Racine. Hey, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, as someone who's actually been involved in testing related to product expiry, I'm going to tell you that it is not in the company's best interest, it is not in the store's best interest, economic or otherwise, to leave something on the shelf longer than a time in which it's reasonable to expect that there is either going to be some kind of a wholesomeness problem, or there's going to be some kind of a problem with taste, texture, something that's going to turn the consumer off. If you think about it, companies that are out there selling these products, they are trying to make a profit by selling you a product. They make zero profit. In fact, they incur a loss if they set their expiries too short.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Mike talking about how there's a reason that stores do this and they don't leave it sitting there longer. What would you say to that?
I mean, I think that's a great point, you know, and that was something I was very curious about. You know, it seems like stores would have a built-in interest around not wasting products, you know. A lot of people I talked to said it came down to labor being a bigger, much bigger cost than individual bits of produce especially. So I think that when you come to making these decisions, and again, there was also an expectation around aesthetics that is not always related to taste or definitely not always related to food safety. So again, I think it was about, a lot of times it's about incentivizing not wasting things better. You know, there is obviously an incentive not to waste because you'll lose money, but, you know, I think that there can be other ones. And a lot of it came down to also having the best data around what was being wasted when, you know, how things can be made more efficient.
Let's give the last word to Rosalind, a truck driver on the road. She emailed in and said, I made a delivery a couple days ago to a bakery that distributes to a lot of the stores. They were throwing away perfectly good bread just because the label was wrong. That, to me, is disgraceful. A whole trailer full of bread, 40,000 pounds of bread being thrown away because the label was wrong. That's food waste. That from Rosalind. And we'll leave it there. Rehan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Rehan Harmansi. She is deputy editor at Modern Farmer, and her piece on food waste is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll discuss the discovery of asbestos fibers at the proposed iron mining site in northern Wisconsin. We'll hear what it means for the current debate. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time, I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll look at how one Wisconsin company has spawned a whole new industry of consulting firms, leading to pretty good paying jobs into the six figures.
First, as the battle over a proposed iron ore mine in northern Wisconsin continues, a new wrinkle has been thrown into the mix. The Department of Natural Resources has confirmed that asbestos fibers have been found in a rock sample at the proposed mining site.
While opponents have latched onto this finding as another reason to reject the mine, the DNR says the extent to which the asbestos-like fibers are present is not yet known, and if Gogebic taconite goes through with a formal mining application, more research will need to be done.
Joining us now to talk about that story is Mike Simonson, WPR's reporter in Superior. Mike, as always, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about how these asbestos fibers were found?
It's in the ore body of the Gogebic Range. It hasn't been known until this past week that it was actually in the proposed mine site. Grunerite is what holds the asbestos fibers, and grunerite's found in the UP, where there are also iron ore mines, in the Iron Range of Minnesota. But this was something that the DNR has asked GTAC to look into, and whether or not GTAC has found it or not, I don't know yet, and they're not saying. But an independent geologist with Northland College, which is also the home of the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute, went on a hike with a few other people on Saturday to the bulk mining site of U.S. Steel, which did a lot of bulk sampling, rock sampling in 1960. And there's a bunch of boulders and rocks left over from that sampling. And so they simply chipped away at that, took some pictures, and they found... they're not even calling it asbestos-like fibers. They're calling it asbestos fibers. The DNR calls them asbestos form fibers, and I'm not clear on the difference there, except maybe asbestos form just means that it's the shape of asbestos versus being actual asbestos.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so we know with asbestos, when it's in, say, you know, a house in flooring, that it's generally not a problem unless you get in there and cause a disturbance so that they get loosed into the air. What do we know about how asbestos functions at a mining site like this?
Well, there, like you just mentioned, the big danger is if you disturb it, it gets in the air. And the Tom Fitz, who is the Northland College geoscience professor who found it, said the concentration is 60% of the rock that he sampled at that site, which is way more than what he found. And he's looked at the UP and he's looked at the Iron Range of Minnesota. He said it didn't surprise him that it was found in this deposit, but the thickness of it. So he says that if there's blasting that could happen there just for rock sampling, which they haven't, GTAC doesn't have permission yet for, but that's what they want permission to do. Even bulk sampling, mini mining, would put this stuff in the air and be dangerous for workers and could be transferred, you know, into the air, and where whichever way the wind's blowing, Mellon or Anderson or whatever direction, could be bad for that area too.
So is the idea that it would spread beyond the people who are working on the mining site and maybe waft through the air, getting into some of the nearby communities and towns?
Yeah, that's the concern. The DNR is being much more you know, because this is such a startling revelation that was released over the weekend. They're you know, just let's wait and see. Let's see what else we can find. But that is the concern, if it'll go in the air. But also, there's a history of asbestos being a problem in the water. Back in 1972, the reserve mining case of Silver Bay, which is on Lake Superior, an ore processing plant put taconite tailings with asbestos-like fibers into Lake Superior. And the whole communities of Silver Bay to Duluth had to start drinking bottled water for I don't know how long. But it was a tremendous scare.
Now, as you know, mining has been an incredibly hot-button issue in Wisconsin recently. This may come as news to you, Mike. Yeah, it's a hot-button issue. So how is this changing the way the debate is being shaped so far?
Well, that's still, and I hate this saying, that remains to be seen. But this is going to be a big issue, even as soon as Thursday. The Ashland County Board, and this sampling site was found in the lone sampling site in Ashland County. There are eight other sites, but they're all in Iron County. The Ashland County Board is so concerned about this that they have asked Professor Fitz to testify before the board on Thursday. So I don't know what Ashland County will do or can do. The tribes, are they going to use this as ammunition to get the feds to say, hey, you know, treaty rights say our safety is guaranteed by treaty rights. How this is going to be used and how GTAC will counter it, you know, remains to be seen, I guess. But it's a big player in this.
Now, have they commented on these findings yet? Because I think they previously said they didn't think there was asbestos in the rock.
They did say that. And then in August 13th, the DNR wrote a letter to GTAC and said, we need a lot more information from you. And one of the things was about asbestos and the potential of it being on the site and going in the air if they use explosives. And GTAC has not replied to the DNR from that August 13th letter, at least not as of late yesterday.
Now, we know that asbestos is a bad thing, but could you talk a little bit more about the public health concern that it might present? Should it, you know, get in there and get into people's systems?
Well, mesothelioma is the concern. There are a lot of cases on Minnesota's Iron Range. There's debate about if that's actually from the ore itself or if it's from asbestos, which was a common insulation and used in the 50s and 60s into the 70s. You know, that still is part of the argument. But there, what can't be argued is there are a lot of cases of this kind of lung cancer on Minnesota's Iron Range. So the concern is, would that be a problem here? And the question is, can it be mitigated? Let's say that there is a lot of asbestos in this area, but can they, you know, contain it so it's not going to get into the air? And Professor Fitz doesn't think so. He thinks even something as simple as the bulk sampling will be dangerous. And the DNR says they don't think the bulk sampling would be dangerous. And from the bulk sampling, we'll find out if there's more asbestos in the other sites.
Now, you mentioned that it was found in this rock at a concentration of 60%. Seems like a pretty high number. Does that, as far as you know, does that represent an outlier in terms of what mining companies have found in rock before? Is this a high number that we should be, you know, people should be worried about?
Well, Tom Fitz is worried about it. And Tom Fitz says it's an extraordinarily dense figure. But again, this is where the DNR says, well, let's just wait and see. We need some more facts to come in. I talked again to Professor Fitz today, you know, and we really do need to find out what's in the other sites and if this is uncommon or common. That'll be a factor.
Now, can you give us a little bit of an update about the status of the proposed iron mine and the opposition?
Really, I mean, it never seems like this thing's on hold, but because there's always something that's coming out of it. But really, it's on hold until the DNR makes a decision about whether or not to allow bulk sampling. And that's 2 or 3 months away. They can't do anything until the August 13th letter is answered. And then they have a month to fact find. And then they have a month, meaning the DNR, to make a decision. And then GTAC can go ahead and bulk sample or the project stops. Because if there's not bulk sampling, then it's all over with.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for being here today and keeping us up to date.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
That was Mike Simonson, WPR's reporter up in Superior.
Coming up next, a look at how one Wisconsin company is spawning consulting firms all over the country with some high-paying jobs, too. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Look at Wisconsin business now. We'll talk about a booming Wisconsin industry, electronic healthcare software.
Epic Systems, a national leader in electronic health records, has experienced rapid growth in the past decade as hospitals around the country have begun implementing its programs.
This hasn't just meant success for the company, but also for consulting firms that have piggybacked on their growth. Our guest now wrote a piece about that and the impact that Epic is having on consulting here in Wisconsin and around the country. Kathleen Gallagher is a business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Kathleen, thanks for joining us. Kathleen, are you there?
Hello?
Hi, Kathleen, are you there?
Hey, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yep, I sure can. So tell us, what kind of growth, before we get to the consulting businesses you wrote about, what kind of growth has Epic Software seen in the last decade or so?
Epic has had phenomenal growth. They were founded in 1979. They had revenue of about $1.5 billion with a B this year. It was $47 million with an M in 2000. They employ about 6,800 people, and their workforce has tripled since 2005.
And their gig, their main line of work, is software that healthcare providers use. Is that right?
Yeah, and you know, it really relates to the U.S. government is trying to get all these hospitals and clinics to use electronic medical records, and they are the leader in supplying electronic medical record systems.
And they're a big deal in employment in central Wisconsin of in and of themselves, right?
Yeah, you know, I've heard anecdotally from some of the people I talked to in Madison that there's been kind of this revitalization in downtown Madison, and many people attribute it to all the bright young people from Epic that are being hired there who want to live downtown and go to restaurants and that sort of thing.
And your piece mainly focused now on the spinoffs from Epic and this healthcare software. What are the consulting firms you're talking about?
Yeah, so what happens, I've used spinoff loosely. What happens is when Epic goes in to put a system in, you know, anyone who's gone to Aurora or Freighter and Children's in Milwaukee, I'm sure there are others around the state, when they put in one of these systems, you can imagine how much work it is to get everything onto a computer system. Well, the Epic people come in, and they'll have one or two Epic employees overseeing all this. They rely on the fact, Epic's philosophy is, you know, we don't want to do this and then walk away and you don't know what you're doing. We want you to be engaged in this system because you're going to have to live with it. So Epic assumes that they're going to have some of their people and hire some consultants who can really help them get the whole thing working.
And then, hence the rise of these consulting businesses. Now, are we talking about a bunch of consulting businesses concentrated here in Wisconsin, or are they springing up all over the country to help healthcare providers in other states, too?
They're springing up all over the country. So there are several big ones, relatively, you know, reasonably sized ones in Madison, but all the big accounting firms now have an Epic practice. I even heard, I couldn't document this, but someone told me anecdotally that there's one hospital system that actually has an Epic consulting group within its system that goes out and helps other hospitals add these systems.
And how big a difference do you think this is making to our economy here in Wisconsin? Obviously, in the worlds of politics and business, there's a lot of focus on trying to get jobs, especially higher paying jobs in the state.
Epic has made a huge difference, just Epic alone, because, first of all, of the talent they're bringing in, you know, they hire a lot of liberal arts grads from the best universities in the country. You know, it's interesting that they're bringing in so many people and they're, you know, creating such a huge tax base in their ever-growing facility. They don't get much attention. The woman who founded Epic, Judy Faulkner, is someone who doesn't seek attention, and they've always been a relatively quiet company in terms of promoting themselves in the popular press and that sort of thing. So, you know, you watch from a vantage point like mine, and we're always talking about, you know, how are we going to grow the economy in the state, and rarely does EPIC figure into that discussion, yet they're a huge part of the economic growth in the state.
And with these consultancies, could I just, assuming I had some relevant skills at all, go off and say, okay, hey, I'm putting up my shingle, I am now an EPIC consultant, or does EPIC have something to say about that?
You absolutely could not do that. EPIC has a lot to say about it. EPIC controls who can be a consultant. They are the only organization that certifies these consultants. Most of the consultants have either worked at EPIC or they've worked in a hospital system, because when you think about it, excuse me, not only do you have to understand these systems and the software, you have to understand the workflow at the hospital and what they do. So EPIC has modules. You know, the module for the OBGYN function in a hospital is called STORC. Some of the names are very clever. And so you have to understand, you know, when a woman comes in and she's pregnant, you know, what happens? You know, what kind of appointments does she have to have? Who does she have to see when she has the baby? You know, where does she have to go? Because think about, you know, any experience you've had in a clinic or hospital, you need to maybe get blood drawn. You know, your doctor needs to check certain things in your history, and all of that has to be integrated into these EPIC systems.
Is there a sense that EPIC and the Wisconsin-based consultants you're talking about are keeping, you mentioned bringing in some people from out of the state, is this keeping young professionals in Wisconsin who might otherwise go off, venture off to Chicago, New York, California?
Definitely. You know, the University of Wisconsin-Madison has one of the best computer science programs in the country, and historically, you know, it's been the stomping ground of Microsoft and Apple and Facebook and Google. You know, that's where they get a lot of their employees. And I think what's happening is, you know, EPIC is one of the companies that helps to keep some of those people here. And then a lot of the people who come from out of state, they come, they like it. They work at EPIC for 5 years. They leave EPIC and they start a company, or they get a job at a different company. So I think it's had a, particularly in Madison, it's had a huge impact on the state.
Now here in Wisconsin and around the country, I think state economic planners, city planners, you name it, have a dream of getting the equivalent of Silicon Valley in their area. I'm sure we're not there yet, but is there that sort of sense of a synergy of EPIC and these consultancies and maybe other software firms getting this kind of self-perpetuating dynamic that's going to bring more businesses in?
Yeah, and I think it's been very organic. You know, it hasn't come out of any kind of central planning. It's been that, you know, because EPIC has been so successful, they have attracted the kind of people who are people who do things like that, who start companies and who have innovative ideas and who understand IT systems and understand how to market them and how hospitals work. So there are other companies too that have, you know, that I think these people have started. I haven't investigated that fully, but I think there's probably more than just the consulting firms.
Now, I think you wrote that the stimulus back in 2009 helped spark the growth here. How important is that, and how much does it hurt if and when that dries up?
You know, it's huge because it's what's driving all of these hospital systems and doctor's offices to adopt electronic medical records. You know, I talked to one guy about that, one consultant who kind of said, you know, that the downside is when this money dries up, I think it's in 2019, you know, EPIC, there probably has to be kind of an EPIC II system, right? That's maybe less expensive, fewer bells and whistles, whatever, you know, however they decide to address that from a business perspective. But I think in the big picture, EPIC is the leader in the field. There's a publicly traded company called Cerner that's another leader, but EPIC, I think, is ahead of them. So even as this changes and as the government money dries up, you're going to have all of these people. You're going to have all of this business that's happened. You know, it's a game changer, I think.
And is there a concern, and I think you wrote something about this, these consultant firms, they're all based on EPIC. It's like if you're an auto supplier, auto parts maker, and you only make something for a particular type of Ford model. If that model goes out of favor, your business dries up fast. Are people worried about that, and how would they adjust?
You know, my sense is that a lot of these people who work as EPIC consultants, they understand information technology and software, and, you know, you're ahead of the game if you understand that. In today's day and age, you can probably figure out other opportunities. And what we need here is, in any industry we're trying to develop, is a critical mass of experts in that industry. And, you know, Epic is helping us get it.
Outside of this healthcare information systems industry, do we have anything else like that in Wisconsin? There's a big push for agricultural biosciences, and we're going to become Tech Alley or Biotech Alley.
Well, the University of Wisconsin-Madison is one of the biggest research universities in the world, and a lot of their research is in biotech and life sciences. So there is that potential. I'm not, you know, it's probably not, it's not a great time for those kind of industries right now in terms of raising venture capital and stuff, although that will probably change. And there needs to be more expertise built around that. Governor Walker also has a big push for manufacturing right now. And I mean, from my perspective, it seems like that's the thing the state is most focused on, is manufacturing in all forms.
All right, Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kathleen Gallagher. She's a business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll have a link to that on that article she wrote on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll get a fiscal breakdown from a member of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
Then we'll explore the prostate monologues, hear about one man's battle, his experiences, and his life with prostate cancer.
And then a poet shares her pilgrimage through her mother's Alzheimer's disease and share what she's learned over the years and through that experience.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Coming up after the news, a new Frontline documentary takes a look at the concussion crisis in the NFL. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.